you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Douglas Valentine back on the show. Doug is an historian, writer, and poet. Among his several books are The Phoenix Program, The Strength of the Wolf, and Strength of the Pack, two books that cover the history of the war on drugs and the intrigues of narcotics trafficking, and the most recent CIA is Organized Crime. But today I want to discuss his book Hotel Tacloban, his first book. The book is a wartime memoir of his father. His father was a prisoner of war in the Second World War. But the book really is about the trauma that war inflicts, not only on soldiers, but on civilians and society at large.
Okay, let me start out with just a little background about me and my father. The book's about my father. My father was a blue-collar worker. He worked two jobs. After World War II, his first job was driving a truck for Railway Express, which was like UPS in those days. And then when Railway Express Agency went out of business, he got a job at the post office. But he always worked a second job. I grew up in the 1950s and the 1960s. I didn't see much of him. When he wasn't working one job, he was at the other job. For a while, he was the manager of the movie theater in town, and then after that he worked in a liquor store. So he was one of those blue collar guys that had to work two jobs, and my mother had to work too. So he had all the characteristics of a blue collar guy. You know, I was raised to know that there was two classes in society. That there was an upper class and there was a lower class, and the lower class people had to work real hard just to make ends meet. You know, my parents never owned a house. They rented a house that I grew up in. But, you know, it was always touch and go. And so my parents had a hard time making ends meet. And when my father had his first heart attack, at the age of 45 in 1971, I just attributed it to his problems of being stressed out all the time, trying to make ends meet. A lot of people don't understand just how hard it is for working class people to get through today. And if you're living from paycheck to paycheck, life can be very stressful to the point where you can get seriously ill. And you know, that's one of the reasons that there's so much tension in our society today. You know, there's a whole class of people that don't understand what it's like for a lot of Americans who are trying to get by. Anyway, my father and I disagreed about everything. You know, it was the days of the generation gap. I rooted for Joe Namath and the New York Jets, and my father rooted for the Baltimore Colts and Johnny Unitas. He had to be a lot. You know, he didn't like when Muhammad Ali became Muhammad Ali and stopped being Cassius Clay. You know, everybody was upset about that except us in the younger generation. So there was a lot of tension between me and my father. And as a matter of fact, we didn't talk for like 10 years. And I moved away out of the little village that we lived in, and I never really came back. And I was involved in all sorts of things that my parents didn't approve of. But I was always interested in writing, and they knew it. They had wanted me to be a teacher, but I didn't want to be a teacher, and I dropped out of college. And a lot of people actually blamed me for my father having his first heart attack because I dropped out of college, and then like 3 weeks later, he had his heart attack. It was a little village, and there was just a lot of, I felt very constrained, so I left. And didn't have much to do with my parents for the next 10 years. This all becomes relevant. And then in 1981, my father had his second open heart surgery. And while he was recovering from that open heart surgery, he was disturbing all the other patients in the intensive care unit in the hospital. He was having terrible nightmares. And he was having nightmares about his experience in World War II, the things that had happened to him then. And they actually had to move him out of the intensive care ward and into a room by himself, and they called the hospital psychiatrist to come and talk to him. And he told the hospital psychiatrist about what his dreams were about and what was bothering him. And the psychiatrist told him, well, if you ever want to get better, you got to start telling people about what happened to you in World War II, what really happened to you. So my father called me up. I was living in New Hampshire at the time. I was working as a tree surgeon. I climbed trees, and I had done that for like 10 years. But all the time I was reading, I read the Russians, you know, I read everything, and I was trying to be a writer at the same time. And he knew that, and he called me up and he said, Doug, I want you to come home. I got a story to tell you. So I, you know, being a dutiful son, even though my father and I didn't like each other, he said, come home. So I went home. And he told me the story of what happened to him in World War II, which was just mind-blowing. I had no idea. And I remember sitting on the floor. He was sitting on the couch, and I was sitting on the floor in front of him taking notes about what he was saying, and he was just crying his eyes out. And I had never seen my father like that. My father was a real kind of macho guy. And there he was just weeping about a friend of his who had died in his arms in World War II, a guy, just another kid. My father was 16 and this guy was like 17 or 18, and they were best friends for, you know, the few weeks that they were involved with each other, and this guy died in his arms, and he was just crying, talking about it. And then he told me that a few weeks after that event, he was in New Guinea during World War II, in the early days of the war, 1942. The Japanese were actually moving towards Australia. They had come down the whole coast of China, and they had, you know, taken over Vietnam. They were in Burma, Thailand. Thailand actually was allied with Japan in World War II. And anyway, they were coming. They had taken over the Philippines, and they were actually in New Guinea, which at one point is only 50 miles from the north of Australia. General MacArthur, who was the general in charge of the war against the Japanese, had retreated to Australia, and he had made his famous vow that he would return to the Philippines. But it was a very touch-and-go situation, and my father was among a bunch of American soldiers who were sent to New Guinea, which is in the south, Port Moresby of New Guinea, which is the very southern part of New Guinea. And they were the first line of defense at that time against the Japanese, who were coming over these mountains in New Guinea and heading towards Australia. And while my father was in New Guinea, in the early days of World War II, in later part of 1942, he was captured by the Japanese while on a patrol. And for unusual reasons, which I explain in the book, The Hotel Tacloban, he was kept alive and everybody else in this patrol was killed. It was a very terrible experience, one of many he'd been having. And he was put on a ship and he was sent to a Japanese prison camp in the Philippines. And my father explained all that to me in that first day. It was very painful for him to do that, but he told me that he had been a prisoner of war in the islands of the Philippine Islands, on the island of Leyte, in the city of Tacloban during World War II, and that he had never told anybody about it. That the government had made him swear, on punishment of him actually being executed, that if he ever told anybody, he would be arrested by the military police and put on trial for what happened in this prison camp. And so he'd been scared out of his wits his entire life, and he had kept this secret. And according to the hospital, the doctors and the psychiatrists, it was having to keep this secret that had really been the major contributor to his having heart disease. And this was, you know, I mean, it's hard enough being a blue collar worker and working two jobs, but when on top of it, you've got this kind of terrible secret that you got to keep it. That works at you at the same time. And so he had always been very sick. And at that point, that very first day he was telling me this story, I'd always wanted to write a book, and all of a sudden, just sitting there, I realized how I could write the whole book in a minute. It was like a vision. I don't know if that happens with other writers. I think it does to some of us. You actually, the whole book just sort of unfolds itself for you. And I saw that there, and it was the beginning of a really remarkable process of my father and I reaching a reconciliation. And in the, I did many interviews with him over the ensuing months. I tape recorded everything he said because I knew how I wanted to write the book. It was relatively easy for me to structure the questioning, but of course it was very dramatic for him. And at the end of a couple of months, I basically had all the material I needed for the book, and my father and I had, reconciled. We had reached an understanding that, he was the father and I was the son. And it was always his responsibility to make things right. A son can't go to a father and say, make things right, Dad. You know, you're the child. It's the responsibility of the adult, the parent, to make things right. And I certainly... In a sort of theoretical way, I mean, I think a lot of people would agree, the parent always has a kind of authority over the child and has to exercise that in a good way. But anyway, my father did it. And so we became fast friends. We'd hated each other almost all our lives. And in the process of him trying to heal himself and involving me in that process, we became good friends. And it was that way for the rest of our lives. And so writing the book wasn't just an exercise in talking about what it really means to be a soldier, what it really means to be in combat, the kind of things that combat soldiers have to carry with them, but but it was also a book that revealed a really sensational military secret, that there was a prison camp on the island of Leyte in the city of Tacloban in World War II that the military to this day still denies ever existed. And my father was there and he told me the story of it. So, you know, the book is itself is kind of controversial. And given that, you know, anytime you reveal something that's a military secret that's still kept a military secret, people take a lot of shots at you. And but at the same time, over the years, I did find evidence to support everything my father said. So that's the story of the Hotel Tacloban, the very first book I wrote. It was published in 1984 in the United States. I also had an Australian publisher, which published the book the next year. And then in 86, it came out as a paperback, and I actually sold the film rights to the book to the company Angus and, Kennedy Miller, the movie production company that made Mad Max and Road Warrior and a lot of other really famous movies. But they never made the book into a movie. They've sat on it for over 25 years, which is kind of bizarre. Anyway, so it was a good book, and it got very good reviews. People said it just rang true, and you know, I was off on my writing career. I realized, you know, all of a sudden I knew how to write a book. You know, you learn how to write a book by writing a book. And I'll just continue and tell you how that book morphed into me writing the Phoenix Program book, if you're interested to know that.
Sure.
You know, which was the book I wrote about the super secret CIA operation in Vietnam. One of the things my father said to me in the process of writing this book, The Hotel Tacloban, was that he related more to Vietnam veterans than he related to World War II veterans. You know, World War II being the good war, and World War II veterans being honored, and a whole other kind of getting a whole other reaction from the public than Vietnam veterans. And because of Vietnam, the Vietnam War, American soldiers were immersed in fighting amongst the civilian population. A lot of civilians were getting killed, and Vietnam veterans were unsure whether, you know, some 14-year-old kid was carrying a grenade or not. You know, so a lot of, in order to protect themselves and their comrades to whom they owed their loyalty and their, you know, how to cover each other's backs, a lot of civilians got killed, and this really caused a lot of conflict in the United States, and a lot of people in the United States, you had to be there. Although Ken Burns is coming out with a documentary about it now, it's like the 50th anniversary. It's a long time ago. A lot of Vietnam veterans were reviled by the public, and people thought that they were, you know, heartless and just killing civilians for fun and one thing and another. There was tremendous protest against the Vietnam War. And so, like my father, a lot of veterans, Vietnam veterans, could not easily tell people about what they saw and what they did. They had to do the same thing my father did, which was internalize their experience. And so a lot of Vietnam veterans had PTSD. I think you may know more Vietnam veterans have committed suicide since the war than actually died in the war. Some 50,000 American soldiers died in the Vietnam War. A far greater number has committed suicide. They just were in tremendous pressures on a lot of Vietnam veterans, and not least of which was not getting the kind of warm reception that World War II veterans did, but also the fighting a guerrilla war, the nature of a guerrilla war leaves a lot of terrible wounds. So when I wanted to write a second book, and I was searching around for a subject to write about, and I was aware that my father was felt connected to Vietnam veterans, I decided to write a book about the Vietnam War. Was there a part of the Vietnam War that resembled what my father went through? And I went to a VA hospital, and because I had written the book, I was able to get an audience with the director, and I went to the director and I said, well, I want to write a book about the Vietnam War. Is there a part of the Vietnam War that was kept secret? And right away he said, the Phoenix Program. And I said, well, what's the Phoenix Program? And he said, well, there's a guy here who was in Special Forces, and he was in the Phoenix Program, and I'll arrange an interview with him, and he'll tell you all about it. Well, a couple of days later, he called me up, the director of this VA hospital. He said, I'm sorry, the guy won't talk to you. He's afraid. He signed. My father had to sign what was called a non-disclosure statement, a legal document saying he would never discuss the prison camp he was in. That's, you know, the legal hammer that the Army held on him. He signed a document saying, you know, swearing to secrecy. And he said, well, this guy who was in the Special Forces had also signed a non-disclosure statement. The military had made him swear to secrecy about the things he was involved in the Phoenix Program. And even though he discusses it at the hospital with the doctors, he can't go making this public. And he's afraid if he does, he'll lose all his VA benefits or worse. So right away, I had stumbled on this story about the Vietnam War that resembled what happened to my father. And I thought, well, because I understand how these guys feel, maybe they'll talk to me. And that's exactly what happened. I would put the book Hotel Talk Logan to one of these veterans to read, and they immediately knew that I understood what it meant for them to be a soldier, what it meant to carry not just combat experiences around with them, but to have been part of a military operation which had crossed the lines from legality into illegality, and that the things they had done really were things that had violated the rules of law of warfare, the laws of warfare. And so based on the book The Hotel Talk Logan, guys who had been involved in the Phoenix Program started talking to me. And not confidentially, you know, I mean, knowing that I was going to write a book about it, they thought, well, gee, just like you wrote this book about your father, let's get this thing out in the air, because people need to know what happened. By then, the war had been over for 15 or 20 years. And the other part, so I started from working at the ground level with, you know, sergeants and enlisted men who had been involved in the Phoenix Program, but I also sent a copy of this book to William Colby, who was a former director of Central Intelligence and had been a career CIA officer, and was actually during the Vietnam War the guy that oversaw the Phoenix Program. I didn't know anything really about the Phoenix Program, but I knew that Colby had testified to Congress in 1970 and again in 1971 about the Phoenix Program, and I knew, you know, I was able to read that. I was reading everything I could about the Vietnam War and the Phoenix Program, and I knew that he was its main defender. So I sent a copy of the book to Colby. And Colby read it, and he said, yeah, come on down, I'll talk to you. And, you know, which is kind of stunning because, you know, I'm not an academic. I've been a tree surgeon. I climbed trees, you know, and I wasn't a war correspondent. You know, I wasn't some guy like Morley Safer or Neil Sheehan, who, you know, David Halberstam or any of these guys who, Dan Rather, who had actually, you know, been celebrity correspondents during the Vietnam War, you know, made their careers covering the Vietnam War. Nobody knew who I was, and Coley didn't know who I was, but on the strength of his book, he said, yeah, come down for all the same reasons that the book demonstrated that, first of all, I knew what it meant to be a soldier. And second of all, that I knew what it meant to be a soldier who was involved in an operation that would normally be viewed unfavorably by the public, but that I would understand that sometimes in war, there are extenuating circumstances and soldiers have to deal with things that civilians have no conception of whatsoever in the midst of a guerrilla warfare. And so, because I was a fresh face, Cawley agreed to help me, and he started introducing me to the senior CIA officers who had been involved in, actually managed the Phoenix program. The guys who, the high-ranking CIA management personnel who created the Phoenix program, put it together as managers, creating an organization. And all these guys would read the Hotel Tocloven, and of course they knew Colby had sent me to him. And like within 6 months or a year, based on talking to the senior-level CIA guys, I knew more about the Phoenix program than anybody else in the world. And within a year, the CIA guys that I was talking to actually thought that, well, I had to be a CIA officer myself. How could I know this much about the Phoenix program unless I was actually doing some kind of, clandestine CIA history of the thing, or, been one of the go-to reporters that the CIA has, that when it wants a story out, it calls them up and says, we got a story we want you to tell, and wink, wink, nod, nod, and then the guy goes along and he, makes the CIA look like heroes, and, well, maybe they made a mistake here, made a mistake there. Of course, I had no intentions of doing that. One of the things that I discovered right away is that there really was no comparison to what happened to my father in this prisoner of war camp and the kind of things that the CIA was doing in the Phoenix program. It was two completely different set situations. And, my father was just, a nobody with a bunch of other nobodies trying to survive. And that was not the situation with the people who were, running the Phoenix program, especially the CIA guys who were running it. These guys were never, their lives were never in danger. A lot of sergeants or, lower level people may have had an element of danger, but, it really wasn't comparable. And at the same time, even though I wasn't an academic and I wasn't a veteran war correspondent, I was smart enough to see that these guys were spilling their guts to me, and I was getting a really, tremendous story. So I just kept going along, pretending like, I really felt sympathy for them. And within a couple of years, I had, the CIA kept a file on me while all this was going on. And I actually got to see that file eventually. And, eventually they started reporting that, calling me Bad News Valentine and saying that Valentine had uncovered enough information to do the agency harm and damage, and I knew all these secrets about the Phoenix program. What are we going to do about this guy? So it eventually became people stopped thinking that I was on their side, but by then I already had all the information I needed. And that's how the Hotel Tocloven, this book about my father, led to my having this really beyond a PhD level education in how the CIA is organized, how it's compartmented, how the various branches and divisions work together, how executive management puts all this together, how psychological warfare is so important to everything they do, psychological warfare including the relationship that the CIA has with the press and the media, which of course keeps everything it does secret. The CIA could not exist and do all the things it did if the media was actually composed of honest people who were actually reporting what they saw. the CIA and the media are the same thing.
Yeah, Mockingbird.
There's no difference. They're to think that they're somehow, not the same thing is an illusion that got shattered for me within weeks, because I'd be talking to some senior CIA guy, and he'd be mentioning famous Vietnam War correspondents and saying, oh, so-and-so came over to my office every week with a bottle of scotch, and I'd tell him everything that we were up to, and he would know, you know, and in return for him knowing and being in the know, he wouldn't write about it. And so the Phoenix program was basically secret for the first 2 years of its existence. And when it was reported about, it was in the most, you know, sort of general sort of CIA, Seymour Hersh sort of way of reporting about the CIA. It wasn't critical about it. You know, it said, well, a mistake was here, or made here, a mistake was there. But it didn't really get at how the thing is organized, how the CIA is organized, and what it, you know, intentionally does, and the relationship that it has with the media. You know, I saw that right away, and I wrote about it in the book, my book, The Phoenix Program. And I said, Phoenix Program would never have happened if the media, if the, you know, especially the New York Times, hadn't kept it a secret. So when the book came out in 1990, it naturally got a very bad review by the New York Times. You know, I mean, the New York Times was sort of in the same situation as the CIA. I mean, I was revealing its dirty secret, just like I was really revealing the CIA's dirty secret. And they got a guy named Morley Safer to kill my book in a, you know, really terrible negative review in its cradle. And my publisher, which had a publishing company called William Morrow, which was one of the biggest publishing companies in the United States, once the book got a bad review in the New York Times, it didn't put a cent towards publicizing it. You know, I mean, the book just died. And it took me another 15 years, actually, to be able to get another book published. You know, I was basically blacklisted as a result of this negative review by Morley Safer in the New York Times. It, you know, I thought my writing career was over, and became a private eye for a while, and, you know, did other things. In the United States, if they want to destroy a writer's career, you know, they don't have to put you in prison or bump you off. All they have to do is give you a bad review in the New York Times. And thereafter, through the old boy network of publishing houses in the United States, you never get a job. Nobody's ever going to give you an advance or write a book about you, because you're just like the, as I say, the media and the CIA are the same thing. Once you've revealed the CIA's secrets, well, you know, nobody's going to trust you in the publishing world. You know, you're a rogue. You know, you're somebody who tells the truth, which is, you know, anathema to the American media. If people knew what the CIA does on a daily basis, if the media was reporting what the CIA does on a daily basis, our country would not look the way it looks. You know, people would not believe the things that they believe. It is the biggest secret in this country. And it's kept quiet for very good reasons, because a lot of people are making a lot of money by, you know, supporting the CIA and its imperial adventures around the world, and all the illegal things that it does, which is why, you know, last year I wrote a book called The CIA is Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. And it, and again, people tend to blame the CIA for all this, but it couldn't happen unless the media and academia and business and all the other facets of our society that benefit from what the CIA does weren't, you know, partners with it in this adventure. So anyway, and it also wasn't until, this is kind of an interesting anecdote, about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, a friend of mine sent me a link that he had been, you know, searching around Google just for some stuff about the State Department, and he had come across a recording that was done of a State Department event that was held, I think, around 2010 or 2011, in which a bunch of State Department officials and war correspondents who had all been at big shots in the Vietnam War got together and had this little, you know, forum in which they discussed their Vietnam experiences. And one of the speakers was Morley Safer. And Morley Safer told about how, while he was a war correspondent in Vietnam around 1970, which was at the height of the Phoenix program, William Colby called him up on the phone. Colby, at the time, was in charge of an organization called CORD, Civil Operations and Rural Development, Revolutionary Development, of which the Phoenix program was a part. So Colby, at the time, was basically in charge of the Phoenix program. But, of course, he was also a CIA officer, and he was in close relations with all the CIA people in South Vietnam. Anyway, so Morley Safer is telling this story, ha, ha, ha. All these big shot State Department people and war correspondents are there, the elite, the people who rule us. And he's telling this story, and he says, so Colby calls me up and says, hey, Morley, can you disappear for, you know, 3 or 4 days? And everybody goes, ha, 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 you know. Safer said to Colby, can I bring a film crew? And Colby said, no, you got to just come by yourself. No filming allowed. And for the next 3 or 4 days, or how many days it was, 5 days, Colby took Morley Safer to every major CIA facility in South Vietnam, from the Delta into Saigon, 3 Corps, 2 Corps, I Corps. And Morley Safer got to see the interrogation centers, as I described in the Phoenix Program book, the CIA had built which was like a torture chamber, an interrogation center of each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces, which nobody ever reported about. There's not a single, apart from my book, there's no history books that talk about them, and nobody ever wrote about them in the press during the war. Of course, every South Vietnamese individual knew there was an interrogation center because their family and friends were being shuttled through, you know, on a daily basis. But nobody in America got to know that. Anyway, but Morley Safer got to know. Colby took him to the interrogation centers. He took him to the people, introduced him to the people who were running the CIA's hit teams, everybody and everything. And Safer's talking about this, you know, how Colby took him everywhere and showed him everything. And at this conference, he said, and to this day, I still feel constrained that I'm not going to tell you what he told me about and what he showed me. But that's how it works. A guy like William Colby can take a reporter like Morley Safer, initiate him into this sort of Masonic, you know, Knight Templar, yeah, old boy club, and in exchange, he owns this guy for the rest of his life. And when Colby got really, you know, if I can be so vulgar as to say it, pissed off at me for writing this book, you know, he thought he could trust me and I was going to write a nice book and portray him as Lawrence of Arabia and all the CIA guys as, like, you know, crusaders, you know, who were fighting for truth, justice, and the American way. And so I slammed him. So he was really mad at me. And, of course, if the CIA wants the New York Times to do a negative review of somebody's book like mine, that's easy. And, you know, the Times undoubtedly said to him, so who would you recommend that we write this book, write the review that kills Valentine's book, you know? Chances are 99 out of 100. Colby just said, Morley Safer, he owes me one. And it's no mistake that, you know, Colby and the New York Times could call on a guy like Morley Safer to kill my book. And it all, you know, I mean, it had been 25 years. So I was wondering about, well, how did they actually, you know, I mean, I knew they were going to do it, but I didn't know the details until this guy, friend of mine in Germany, sent me this link, and Morley Safer revealed this incestuous relationship that he had with William Colby that it all, you know, finally made sense to me. And I made sure to include that in my new book, because you can believe me when I say that sort of thing happens 100 times, 1,000 times every day across the United States of America. where somebody in the CIA calls up an editor or a movie producer or a film director or, you know, anybody in the media or somebody in academia who's writing a book, and they call in a favor. And they say, don't talk about this, or knock this guy, or, you know, knock this guy out of the box. You know, we need to get, you know, silence him. And that's how censorship works in the United States. You don't have to put somebody in jail. You don't have to have, you know, the secret police come to their door at midnight and take them off and, you know, upset their everybody in their neighborhood. It's simply done economically through this old boy network, where they deny you a career and they make you anathema. And everybody in academia, everybody in the media, everybody in the film industry knows that the first rule is, you don't screw around with the CIA or else your career is over. So it doesn't have to be enforced by, you know, Gestapo-style operations. It's just enforced casually through this old boy network, which is pervasive in the United States. It affects every institution, every civic institution, every private institution, every business organization, especially business organizations that do business overseas. If they want to, if you're a business organization, a corporation in the United States, and you want to do business overseas, you got to cooperate with the CIA, you know, or else you're never going to get it. You know, contacts overseas, you know, and the CIA can subvert any business overseas that it wants to in a day. So, you know, especially business has to play ball. And of course, they do so voluntarily and, you know, wholeheartedly, because the CIA and business, you know, have a partnership overseas as well, of subverting foreign companies, of buying, you know, this is why I call the CIA's organized crime. You know, I mean, they're busy subverting friendly countries, you know, France, Great Britain, Australia, all that secret intelligence that they gather. It just doesn't say locked up in a vault. It's being used so that American businesses can have a competitive edge against a business in Australia, or a Chinese business that's trying to do business in Australia. You know, I mean, that's the main thrust of what the CIA does overseas, is it advances the American way, which is free enterprise. And free enterprise means nobody else has a right to do business, it's just Americans. You know, I mean, that's what free enterprise means. And the CIA is the secret criminal enforcement arm of how this system works. I'll explain all that in this latest book, The CIA's Organized Crime, and how they, you know, it's been set up to do this, and how all these people work together, business overseas with the CIA, and through business connections, you know, the academia, which you can't go to a college in the United States and take a course in the CIA 101. You know, they just don't teach it. You don't learn about it. It's secret. Just like this prison camp that my father was in World War II. The secret. Because if you find out what really happens and what the extent of the evil intentions that they have and the evil practices that they engage in, you're not going to be a good citizen anymore. You know, there's only so much that people can take. Just like you know, when my father got to the point where he had such serious heart disease that the only way he could survive was to get it off his chest. And this is the situation that America finds itself in today. The general population is suffering because of the endless wars which we're subjected to, especially since 9/11. It's wars that make no sense to anybody. I mean, the wars don't even make sense to Donald Trump. You know, and the only thing Donald Trump's interested in is fattening his own wallet, you know, and making sure that his kids are billionaires, you know, for into infinity, and their kids. You know, I mean, the guy's a crook. But, you know, even he ran on a platform that America's had enough stupid wars. Mm-hmm. And it got him elected. People relate to that because just like my father was traumatized, just like Vietnam veterans were traumatized, just like there's a million veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, guys who after 9/11 volunteered and went off to fight what they thought was terrorism. And they soon found out that they were just being glorified cops in the, you know, for the imperial elite. And you come back, and how do you resolve those feelings? You know, well, you either buy into this myth, which a lot of them do too. You know, maybe you get a nice job at the Department of Homeland Security, so you say, well, I'm just going to throw in with these guys because they're winning and they got control of everything, and I might as well be with them, be their Praetorian guard. You know, or you become very desperately disillusioned. In any event, there's a great swath, percentage of the American public, which has become really disillusioned. And it's suffering from a kind of PTSD of just endless war, which all it does is, you know, deplete their own pocketbooks and their kids, you know, find themselves owing $100,000 to the bank when they graduate college. You know, I mean, it just doesn't have to be that way. You know, and their kids can't buy a house. It's, you know, like what it was for my father, working two jobs and my mother having to work. I mean, everybody sees them, you know, working people see themselves in this situation now. And they know it doesn't have to be that way. But they can never quite put their finger on why. Because the essential things that are happening and creating this really awful situation are hidden. They're secret. You know, and it's so hard to get at the secrets. And there's so many prohibitions for revealing secrets. And the secret services that are in charge of this just keep making it harder and harder and harder for anybody who's part of this to reveal the secrets. I mean, they all sign non-disclosure statements. They're all legally bound to keep these secrets, which enable the ruling elite to maintain their privileged status. And so we have a society that's just really, everybody knows it. Everybody talks about it all the time. We see it. It's just falling apart. It's just eating its own kids, its own offspring. It's a constant battle in the media. You know, you have Fox News, which says Trump could do no wrong, you know, and Trump saying, you know, anybody who criticizes him is spreading fake news, you know, and then on the other side of perspective, you say, well, everything Trump does is wrong, you know, and anybody who says differently is spreading fake news to the point where nobody knows, well, what the hell? What's true? What's false? And everybody feels that very deeply these days. And it has a traumatizing effect on our society. And if we ever really want to be whole, you know, we all got to try to start doing, in a sense, what my father and I did. We got to try to find some way to reconcile. We got to each try to work at some way to find out what the truth is in a way that is beneficial for everybody and helps everybody to heal and to get over these, like, really illnesses that are imposed upon us, these fake fights that are imposed upon us, these rifts and divisions in society that are imposed upon us by our rulers. And they, believe me when I tell you, this is all intentionally done. You know, we, the way the people who are our rulers, you know, at the CIA and in the media and in academia, at the highest levels are all, you know, business, are all working together because they're glad to see us at each other's throats. This is what they want. We can't do anything to make our own lives better because we're so involved in petty squabbles when the actual overall problems, which is that we're ruled by a ruthless, evil ruling elite, you know, which has set up a situation which, it, you know, to perpetuate its own and advance its own interests. You know, I mean, it's very simple, but at the same time, it's a long way from the head of the dog to the tip of the tail. And you got to understand how it's all organized. And in my books, that's what I try to do. It's hard reading for a lot of people, but there is a method to the madness, and things are organized, including with this, you know, forcing people to keep secrets, just like my father was forced to keep secrets, and so many people, you know, soldiers nowadays, through so many classification systems, and, you know, I mean, it just goes on and on. I enumerated it all, but there's like a lot of secrecy imposed on everybody. Well, we got to get past all the secrets and just start airing all this stuff and really making it a priority. So anyway, that's how you know, a kid who was a tree surgeon, you know, and not an act, you know, college dropout, you know, I mean, and just a blue collar kid got to know things, you know, I mean, and try to make a difference, you know, and it's been a long time, you know, 35 years now.
Yeah, one of the more interesting parts of that's pointed out in Hotel Tacloban is you, and you alluded to this when you were talking, is that because your father was, his true story at the prison camp was covered up, and a fake story was produced. He was more or less sheep dipped, as they say. It was a fake career.
A term you don't hear much anymore.
Yeah, and this led him to develop a certain skeptical view towards official stories. Correct. Like the JFK assassination, you relate that experience, I think, in an interview?
Yeah, the military is capable of sending a soldier, you know, like saying, this guy is a finance officer, and he works in an administrative capacity in Saigon, and sits at an office desk all day long. And if you look at his military records, that's what it says. And every day of his career, the 6 months or a year, 2 years that he spent in Vietnam, is accounted for. And at the same time, this guy could be an assassin, you know, actually running around the countryside. I mean, and this is what the CIA does. I mean, the CIA has what's called a central cover staff. It creates cover stories for people. And as part of creating a cover story for a person, and the military does the same thing, it's like, you know, like the mafia has two sets of books for a business that it runs. You know, it's got the set of books that it presents to the IRS, and then it's got, you know, a set of books that you present to Don Vito so he knows how much money he's really making, and, you know, and he can tell whether or not Joe Valachi's run, you know, skimming money from them, you know. So there's all these the military and the CIA both always have two sets of books for all their clandestine operators, and they can actually go back in time because they control the record keeping part. You know, I mean, it's like I said, these things are very. It's you got to understand how they're managed, how people can be sheeted, and that. That happened infrequently in World War II, although everybody who was in the OSS, which was the parent agency for the CIA, every one of them was sheeped. They all had a false record saying that they were doing something when they were really doing something else. And of course, everybody in the CIA, you know, has a cover story and then does what they, you know, the story of what they really do, and the military is very very good at this too. But during Vietnam War, we used to hear about sheep dipped all the time. You never hear about it anymore. Nobody reports on these things. Nobody's, you know, they just report the cover story, and nobody even reports that there's something other than a cover story, you know. So all you ever know is the cover story, and that's because since Vietnam, you know, the powers that be in who run the CIA and the military have just made sure that nobody can talk about these things anymore. You know, it's become the, you know, quite frankly, the fantasy has become the reality, which is another reason people are so confused. But yeah, that happened to my father, and who, you know, was a very wizened guy and could see through, you know, all the bullshit. You know, I mean, he you couldn't pull the wool over his eyes. You know, I mean, he was always looking behind the screen, and I remember he, you know, in 1967, even when we were still not talking to me, he gave me Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment. And he said, "No, you should read this book. You know, it might be of interest to you." You know, I mean, he could just, you know, I mean, there was things that, you know, he just didn't trust authority in, which is a good way to behave, you know, a good attitude to take, is that, you know, what you're being told is, you know, not for your benefit. It's to keep you off balance and keep you from knowing what's really going on. Anyway, I've talked nonstop, and I hope that's enough for you for one day. I'm kind of petering out.
Oh, no, yeah, that's excellent. That's great. Want to thank you for coming back on the show. I'll add a few remarks. There's one thing that what I'm talking about is the generational gap that the war created, and you experienced this. Is that a lot of the trauma of the Vietnam War also coincided with things that are occurring here at home at the, you know, on the home front. You know, the changes in music, the cultural, the introduction. Of course, Vietnam played a big part in the introduction of drugs into American society, and so did the CIA. So all of these generational gaps are being aggravated by the corporate elite. And I think you alluded to it, is that our leaders know how to divide and conquer, and much of what you experienced with your father because of the war was being agitated here at home through a sort of a cultural domestic program. You say sort of a domestic phoenix program to tear apart society. Would you agree that there's a lot of truth to that analysis?
An analysis of how phoenixes sort of come home to roost?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's no better example than the Department of Homeland Security, okay? The Phoenix program, what it did was it coordinated. I did lengthy interviews with a senior CIA officer named Nelson Brickham, who graduated magna cum laude from Yale University with a degree in organizational behavior. And when the CIA wanted to create the Phoenix program, it called on this guy, Nelson Brickham, who at that point had been in the CIA for 20 years. And what he did was, Phoenix was actually a way of coordinating 25 programs that were already in existence. Anybody who worked for Phoenix was called a Phoenix coordinator. And Phoenix centers, coordinating centers, they were called IOCs, Intelligence and Operations Coordinating Centers. One of them was set up in every district in South Vietnam. That's there were 244 districts. So each district had a DIOC, a District Intelligence Operations and Coordinating Center, which was computerized. And every province, there were 44 provinces, and, you know, like, do the math, you know, yeah. 10 or 20 DIOCs in each province. Every DIOC reported to a province Intelligence Operations Coordinating Center. And there's 44 of them, so there's a Phoenix Center in every district, there's a Phoenix Center in every province, one in every corps, and one at a Phoenix Directorate in Saigon, which would be like the Department of Homeland Security headquarters. And in these Intelligence Operations Coordinating Centers, what they did was they coordinated every police and law enforcement organization in that district with every intelligence organization, whether it was military intelligence, army intelligence, navy intelligence, South Vietnamese police intelligence, CIA. So right across the board, every kind of program that was in existence spying on potential terrorists or anybody who could be thought to be a sympathizer with terrorists, or anybody who was in any way acting against the interests of the government, including domestic political parties, you know, every element, law enforcement, military intelligence, was coordinated at Phoenix, and it drew from all that intelligence, and any of the operational elements of the police or the military or the CIA that was best suited to go off and neutralize this suspect could be called to put into action at a moment's notice. Okay, and the higher and the more important this suspected terrorist or dissident was, you know, the greater level of attention they got. You know, at the province level, there were more important people. At the, you know, core level, there was more important people. And of course, at headquarters, you know, you're targeting the leaders of political parties, you know, the leaders of social movements, as opposed to the members of, you know, foot soldiers in all the political and social movements that you want to control. Well, guess what? The Department of Homeland Security was set up exactly like that, with these intelligence operations and coordinating centers. And it's no secret anymore that basically the Department of Homeland Security is structured exactly like Phoenix was. It coordinates every law enforcement, military, and intelligence agency that operates in the United States. And it does the same thing that Phoenix does. It directs them. It collects intelligence about everybody. It has access to every informant that exists, whether you're informant for the DEA or the Chicago Police Department or the police in your local village. Every informant, the Department of Homeland Security has, you know, access to them and knows who they are. And they can turn one of these informants to a person who's going to, like, you know, do something to destroy your career or somehow suppress you, just like Colby and Morley Safer in the New York Times got together to squash my career. Well, the Department of Homeland Security is political, operates under political control. So whoever's in charge politically at the United States at any point or in any state just uses this apparatus to go after its business opponents and competitors, its political opponents. Suppress any social movement in a minute, which is one of the reasons why it's so hard for Americans to organize nowadays.
Yeah,
we're just swamped with this huge secret apparatus, which thwarts every kind of, anytime you try to make any kind of movement towards stepping out of line or fighting authority, it's known, and this apparatus is in place and has a 100 different ways of suppressing you. And business and civic institutions are the main part of it. Businesses keep track, feed information to the Department of Homeland Security about employees who are getting out of line. And if you're an employee for Westinghouse or Hewlett Packard or Microsoft and you're looking a little squirrely, you know, well, you're going to be out of a job. You know, you're all of a sudden, you know, everybody knows about it. So this huge surveillance and operational apparatus is in place nowadays. And it's intelligence and it's operations. It's subtle operations that are designed absolutely to not only suppress political and social movements that are anti-capitalist, you know, for one thing, but to pit them against each other, which is the greatest psychological warfare weapon that the power elites have, which is just really through provocateurs and misinformation, you know, fake news, just pitting blacks against whites, Jews against Catholics, you know, you name it, any kind of diverse groups, men against women, you know, instead of having a power elite that's dedicated to fostering peaceful relations amongst its citizens, it's exactly the opposite. It's just trying to do all it can to keep everybody at each other's throats, and it's very subtle, but it's also pervasive, and so it's very important for people to understand this and to really try to have a humanistic, conciliatory approach towards each other and to treat each other. You know, I'm not saying you got to go to church or You know, it's not that. You know, I mean, it's not a religious thing. It's that if you want to survive this prison camp that we're in, which is what really the Hotel Tacloban in that book I wrote is really about. You know, it's a metaphor. We are all in a prison camp, folks. And, you know, the people that are running the prison camp are, you know, conspiring to keep you in shackles. And if you really want to, you know, get over it, we got to work with each other and cooperate with each other and you know, just treat each other a little bit better.
Yes, excellent point. Through surveillance and harassment, our basic rights for free speech and redress have been effectively been avoided. Because should we become a spur in the side, a real challenge to power, or should we really question authority and present a real challenge to the powers that be, we're effectively snuffed out. And that's it's done in America. It's done very subtly. And that's it's different. I think East Germany, the Stasi had a thing called, they called it disintegration. They wouldn't necessarily immediately arrest you. You gradually lose friends, lose employment, and suffer ostracism, and you'd psychologically disintegrate, and you might end up committing suicide.
Yeah, you know what we started out talking about, you know, and it's not that complex. You know, but at the same time, it's hard, you know. And anyway, I'm pooped out.
And no, yes, I want to thank you, Douglas. I want to thank you. I'll let you go. When I post this, I will send you the link. And so you'll have that. And that's Douglas Valentine. He's an investigative journalist, historian, and poet, best known for his books on the CIA. We talked about his book on the Phoenix Program. He's also written a couple of excellent books on the war on drugs or narcotics trade. That's The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack, a must-read if you want to know the true nature of the drug war. And, of course, the CIA is organized crime, a must-read if you want to know how the world really is run today. Thank you, Doug.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you. And, you know, again, enjoy the rest of the summer up there. And maybe fall, winter, we'll talk again. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, just send me a link if you don't mind.
Oh, I will do. I'll send you a link when it's up.
Okay.
So long, then.
Okay.
You
Thank
too.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.